The Secrets of Divine Civilization, cassette number 2, side 1, continuing from page 48.
Time passed and famine fell on the land of Tay. Hanzalah was in dire need, and for this reason he sought out the king. By a strange coincidence, he arrived on the day of evil. Newman was greatly troubled in spirit. He began to reproach his friend, saying, "Why did you come to your friend on this day of all days? For this is the day of evil, that is, the day of wrath and the day of distress. This day should my eyes alight on Kabus, my only son. He should not escape with his life. Now ask me whatever favor you will." Hanzalah said, "I knew nothing of your day of evil. As for the gifts of this life, they are meant for the living, and since I, at this hour, must drink of death, what can all the world's storehouses avail me now?" Newman said, "There is no help for this." Hanzalah told him, "Respite me then, that I may go back to my wife and make my testament. Next year I shall return on the day of evil." Newman then asked for a guarantor, so that if Hanzalah should break his word, this guarantor would be put to death instead. Hanzalah, helpless and bewildered, looked about him. Then his gaze fell on one of Newman's retinue, Sharik, son of Amr, son of Kays of Shaban, and to him he recited these lines, "O my partner, O son of Amr, is there any escape from death? O brother of every afflicted one, O brother of him who is brotherless, O brother of Newman, in thee today is a surety for the Sheikh. Where is Shaban the noble? May the All-Merciful favor him." But Sharik only answered, "O my brother, a man cannot gamble with his life." At this, the victim could not tell where to turn. Then a man named Karad, son of Adjah, the Kalbite, stood up and offered himself as a surety, agreeing that, should he fail on the next day of wrath to deliver up the victim, the king might do with him, Karad, as he wished. Newman then bestowed 500 camels on Hanzalah and sent him home. In the following year, on the day of evil, as soon as the true dawn broke in the sky, Newman, as was his custom, set out with pomp and pageantry and made for the two mausoleums called the Smeared with Blood. He brought Karad along to wreak his kingly wrath upon him. The pillars of the state then loosed their tongues and begged for mercy, imploring the king to respite Karad until sundown, for they hoped that Hanzalah might yet return. But the king's purpose was to spare the life of Hanzalah and to requite his hospitality by putting Karad to death in his place. As the sun began to set, they stripped off the garments of Karad and made ready to sever his head. At that moment, a rider appeared in the distance, galloping at top speed. Newman said to the swordsman, "Why delayest thou?" The minister said, "Perchance it is Hanzalah who comes." And when the rider drew near, they saw it was none other. Newman was sorely displeased. He said, "Thou fool, thou didst slip away once from the clutching fingers of death. Must thou provoke him now a second time?" And Hanzalah answered, "Sweet in my mouth and pleasant on my tongue is the poison of death at the thought of redeeming my pledge." Newman asked, "What could be the reason for this trustworthiness, this regard for thine obligation, and this concern for thine oath?" And Hanzalah answered, "It is my faith in the one God and in the books that have come down from heaven." Newman asked, "What faith dost thou profess?" And Hanzalah said, "It was the holy breath of Jesus that brought me to life." I follow the straight pathway of Christ, the Spirit of God. Newman said, let me inhale these sweet aromas of the Spirit. So it was that Hansela drew out the white hand of guidance from the bosom of the love of God and illumined the sight and the insight of the beholders with the gospel light. After he had, in bell-like accents, recited some of the divine verses out of the Evangel, Newman and all his ministers sickened of their idols and their idol worship and were confirmed in the faith of God, and they said, alas, a thousand times alas, that up to now we were careless of this infinite mercy and veiled away therefrom, and were bereft of this rain from the clouds of the grace of God. Then straightway the king tore down the two monuments called the Smeared with Blood, and he repented of his tyranny and established justice in the land. Observe how one individual, and he a man of the desert, to outward seeming unknown and of no station, because he showed forth one of the qualities of the pure in heart, was able to deliver this proud sovereign and a great company of others from the dark night of unbelief and guide them into the morning of salvation, to save them from the perdition of idolatry and bring them to the shores of the oneness of God, and to put an end to practices of the sort which blight a whole society and reduce the peoples to barbarism. One must think deeply over this and grasp its meaning. My heart aches, for I note with intense regret that the attention of the people is nowhere directed toward that which is worthy of this day and time. The Sun of Truth has risen above the world, but we are ensnared in the dark of our imaginings. The waters of the most great sea are surging all around us, while we are parched and weak with thirst. The divine bread is coming down from heaven, and yet we grope and stumble in a famine-stricken land. Between the weeping and the telling, I spin out my days. One of the principal reasons why people of other religions have shunned and failed to become converted to the faith of God is fanaticism and unreasoning religious zeal. See, for example, the divine words that were addressed to Muhammad, the Ark of Salvation, the Luminous Countenance, and Lord of Men, bidding him to be gentle with the people and long-suffering. Debate with them in the kindliest manner. That blessed tree whose light was neither of the east nor of the west, and who cast over all the peoples of the earth the sheltering shade of a measureless grace, showed forth infinite kindness and forbearance in his dealings with everyone. In these words, likewise, were Moses and Aaron commanded to challenge Pharaoh, Lord of the Stakes, the Impaler. Speak ye to him with gentle speech. Although the noble conduct of the prophets and holy ones of God is widely known, and it is indeed until the coming of the hour in every aspect of life an excellent pattern for all mankind to follow, nevertheless, some have remained neglectful of and separated from these qualities of extraordinary sympathy and loving kindness, and have been prevented from attaining to the inner significances of the holy books. Not only do they scrupulously shun the adherents of religions other than their own, they do not even permit themselves to show them common courtesy. If one is not allowed to associate with another, how can one guide him out of the dark and empty night of denial of there is no God into the bright morning of belief and the affirmation but God? And how can one urge him on and encourage him to rise up out of the abyss of perdition and ignorance and climb the heights of salvation and knowledge? Consider justly, had not Hansela treated Newman with true friendship, showing him kindness and hospitality, could he have brought the king and a great number of other idolaters to acknowledge the unity of God? To keep aloof from people, to shun them, to be harsh with them, will make them shrink away, while affection and consideration, mildness and forbearance, will attract their hearts toward God. If a true believer, when meeting an individual from a foreign country, should express revulsion and should speak the horrible words forbidding association with foreigners and referring to them as unclean, the stranger would be grieved and offended to such a point that he would never accept the faith, even if he should see, taking place before his very eyes, the miracle of the splitting of the moon. The results of shunning him would be this, that if there had been in his heart some faint inclination toward God, he would repent of it and would flee away from the sea of faith into the wastes of oblivion and unbelief. And upon returning home to his own country, he would publish in the press statements to the effect that such and such a nation was utterly lacking in the qualifications of a civilized people. If we ponder a while over the Quranic verses and proofs and the traditional accounts which have come down to us from those stars of the heaven of divine unity, the holy imams, we shall be convinced of the fact that if a soul is endowed with the attributes of true faith and characterized with spiritual qualities, he will become to all mankind an emblem of the outstretched mercies of God. For the attributes of the people of faith are justice and fair-mindedness, forbearance and compassion and generosity, consideration for others, candor, trustworthiness and loyalty, love and loving-kindness, devotion and determination and humanity. If, therefore, an individual is truly righteous, he will avail himself of all those means which will attract the hearts of men, and through the attributes of God, he will draw them to the straight path of faith and cause them to drink from the river of everlasting life. Today we have closed our eyes to every righteous act and have sacrificed the abiding happiness of society to our own transitory profit. We regard fanaticism and zealotry as redounding to our credit and honor, and not content with this, we denounce one another and plot each other's ruin. And whenever we wish to put on a show of wisdom and learning, of virtue and godliness, we set about mocking and reviling this one and that. The ideas of such a one, we say, are wide of the mark, and so-and-so's behavior leaves much to be desired. The religious observances of Zayd are few and far between, and Amr is not firm in his faith. So-and-so's opinions smack of Europe. Fundamentally, blank thinks of nothing but his own name and fame. Last night, when the congregation stood up to pray, the roll was out of line, and it is not permissible to follow a different leader. No rich man has died this month, and nothing has been offered to charity in memory of the prophet. The evidence of religion has crumbled. The foundations of faith have been blown to the winds. The carpet of belief has been rolled up, the tokens of certitude blotted out. The whole world has fallen into error. When it comes to repelling tyranny, all are soft and remiss. Days and months have passed away, and these villages and estates still belong to the same owners as they did last year. In this town, there used to be 70 different governments functioning in good order, but the number has steadily decreased. There are only 25 left now as a memento. It used to be that 200 contradictory judgments were handed down by the same mufti in any one day. Now we hardly get 50. In those days, there were crowds of people who were all brain sick with litigation, and now they rest in peace. Today, the plaintiff would be defeated and the defendant victorious. Tomorrow, the plaintiff won the case and the defendant lost it. But now this excellent practice has been abandoned too. What is this heathenish religion, this idolatrous kind of error? Alas for the law, alas for the faith. Alas for all these calamities. O brothers in the faith, this is surely the end of the world. The judgment is coming. With words such as these, they assault the minds of the helpless masses and disturb the hearts of the already bewildered poor, who know nothing of the true state of affairs and the real basis for all such talk, and remain completely unaware of the fact that 1,000 selfish purposes are concealed behind the supposedly religious eloquence of certain individuals. They imagine that speakers of this type are motivated by virtuous zeal, when the truth is that such individuals keep up a great hue and cry because they see their own personal ruin in the welfare of the masses and believe that if the people's eyes are opened, their own light will go out. Only the keenest insight will detect the fact that if the hearts of these individuals were really impelled by righteousness and the fear of God, the fragrance of it would, like musk, be spreading everywhere. Nothing in the world can ever be supported by words alone. But these ill-omened owls have done a wrong, and learned to sing as the white falcon sings. And what of Sheba's message that the lapwing brings? If the bittern learn to sing the lapwing's song. The spiritually learned, those who have derived infinite significance and wisdom from the book of divine revelation, and whose illumined hearts draw inspiration from the unseen world of God, certainly exert their efforts to bring about the supremacy of the true followers of God in all respects and above all peoples, and they toil and struggle to make use of every agency that will conduce to progress. If any man neglects these high purposes, he can never prove acceptable in the sight of God. He stands out with all his shortcomings and claims perfection, and destitute pretends to wealth. One sluggish, blind, and surly's a poor thing, a lump of flesh without a foot or wing. How far is he who apes and makes a show from the illumined who doth truly know? One but an echo, though it's clear and sharp, and one the psalmist David with his harp. Knowledge, purity, devotion, discipline, independence have nothing to do with outer appearance and dress. Once in the course of my travels, I heard an eminent personage make the following excellent remark, the wit and charm of which remain in memory. Not every cleric's turban is a proof of continence and knowledge. Not every layman's hat a sign of ignorance and immorality. How many a hat has proudly raised the banner of knowledge? How many a turban pulled down the law of God? The third element of the utterance under discussion is, opposes his passions. How wonderful are the implications of this deceptively easy, all-inclusive phrase. This is the very foundation of every laudable human quality. Indeed, these few words embody the light of the world, the impregnable basis of all the spiritual attributes of human beings. This is the balance wheel of all behavior, the means of keeping all man's good qualities in equilibrium. For desire is a flame that has reduced to ashes uncounted lifetime harvests of the learned, a devouring fire that even the vast sea of their accumulated knowledge could never quench. How often has it happened that an individual who was graced with every attribute of humanity and wore the jewel of true understanding nevertheless followed after his passions until his excellent qualities passed beyond moderation and he was forced into excess. His pure intentions changed to evil ones. His attributes were no longer put to uses worthy of them, and the power of his desires turned him aside from righteousness and its rewards into ways that were dangerous and dark. A good character is, in the sight of God and his chosen ones and the possessors of insight, the most excellent and praiseworthy of all things, but always on condition that its center of emanation should be reason and knowledge, and its base should be true moderation. Were the implications of this subject to be developed as they deserve, the work would grow too long, and our main theme would be lost to view. All the peoples of Europe, notwithstanding their vaunted civilization, sink and drown in this terrifying sea of passion and desire, and this is why all the phenomena of their culture come to nothing. Let no one wonder at this statement or deplore it. the primary purpose, the basic objective in laying down powerful laws and setting up great principles and institutions dealing with every aspect of civilization is human happiness. And human happiness consists only in drawing closer to the threshold of Almighty God and in securing the peace and well-being of every individual member, high and low alike, of the human race. And the supreme agencies for accomplishing these two objectives are the excellent qualities with which humanity has been endowed. A superficial culture, unsupported by a cultivated morality, is as a confused medley of dreams. An external luster without inner perfection is like a vapor in the desert, which the thirsty dreameth to be water. For results which would win the good pleasure of God and secure the peace and well-being of man could never be fully achieved in a merely external civilization. The peoples of Europe have not advanced to the higher planes of moral civilization, as their opinions and behavior clearly demonstrate. Notice, for example, how the supreme desire of European governments and peoples today is to conquer and crush one another, and how, while harboring the greatest secret repulsion, they spend their time exchanging expressions of neighborly affection, friendship, and harmony. There is the well-known case of the ruler who is fostering peace and tranquility and at the same time devoting more energy than the warmongers to the accumulation of weapons and the building up of a larger army on the grounds that peace and harmony can only be brought about by force. Peace is the pretext, and night and day they are all straining every nerve to pile up more weapons of war, and to pay for this, their wretched people must sacrifice most of whatever they are able to earn by their sweat and toil. How many thousands have given up their work in useful industries and are laboring day and night to produce new and deadlier weapons which would spill out the blood of the race more copiously than before? Each day they invent a new bomb or explosive, and then the government must abandon their obsolete arms and begin producing the new, since the old weapons cannot hold their own against the new. For example, at this writing in the year 1292 AH, they have invented a new rifle in Germany and a bronze cannon in Austria, which have greater firepower than the Martini-Henry rifle and the Krupp cannon, are more rapid in their effects and more efficient in annihilating humankind. The staggering cost of it all must be borne by the hapless masses. Be just. Can this nominal civilization, unsupported by a genuine civilization of character, bring about the peace and well-being of the people or win the good pleasure of God? Does it not, rather, connote the destruction of man's estate and pull down the pillars of happiness and peace? At the time of the Franco-Prussian War in the year 1870 of the Christian era, it was reported that 600,000 men died broken and beaten on the field of battle. How many a home was torn out by the roots? How many a city, flourishing the night before, was toppled down by sunrise? How many a child was orphaned and abandoned? How many an old father and mother had to see their sons, the young fruit of their lives, twisting and dying in dust and blood? How many women were widowed, left without a helper or protector? And then there were the libraries and magnificent buildings of France that went up in flames, and the military hospital packed with sick and wounded men that was set on fire and burned to the ground. And there followed the terrible events of the Commune, the savage acts, the ruin and horror when opposing factions fought and killed one another in the streets of Paris. There were the hatreds and hostilities between Catholic religious leaders and the German government. There was the civil strife and uproar, the bloodshed and havoc brought on between the partisans of the Republic and the Carlists in Spain. Only too many such instances are available to demonstrate the fact that Europe is morally uncivilized. Since the writer has no wish to cast aspersions on anyone, he has confined himself to these few examples. It is clear that no perceptive and well-informed mind can countenance such events? Is it right and proper that peoples among whom, diametrically opposed to the most desirable human behavior, such horrors take place, should dare lay claim to a real and adequate civilization? Especially when out of all this no results can be hoped for except the winning of a transient victory. And since this outcome never endures, it is, to the wise, not worth the effort. Time and again, down the centuries, the German state has subdued the French. Over and over, the Kingdom of France has governed German lands. Is it permissible that in our day, 600,000 helpless creatures should be offered up as a sacrifice to such nominal and temporary uses and results? No, by the Lord God, even a child can see the evil of it. Yet the pursuit of passion and desire will wrap the eyes in 1,000 veils that rise out of the heart to blind the sight and the insight as well. Desire and self come in the door and blot out virtue bright before, and 100 veils will rise from the heart to blind the eyes. True civilization will unfurl its banner in the midmost heart of the world whenever a certain number of its distinguished and high-minded sovereigns, the shining exemplars of devotion and determination, shall, for the good and happiness of all mankind, arise with firm resolve and clear vision to establish the cause of universal peace. They must make the cause of peace the object of general consultation and seek by every means in their power to establish a union of the nations of the world. They must conclude a binding treaty and establish a covenant, the provisions of which shall be sound, inviolable, and definite. They must proclaim it to all the world and obtain for it the sanction of all the human race. This supreme and noble undertaking, the real source of the peace and well-being of all the world, should be regarded as sacred by all that dwell on earth. All the forces of humanity must be mobilized to ensure the stability and permanence of this most great covenant. In this all-embracing pact, the limits and frontiers of each and every nation should be clearly fixed, the principles underlying the relations of governments towards one another definitely laid down, and all international agreements and obligations ascertained. In like manner, the size of the armaments of every government should be strictly limited, for if the preparations for war and the military forces of any nation should be allowed to increase, they will arouse the suspicion of others. The fundamental principle underlying this solemn pact should be so fixed that if any government later violate any one of its provisions, all the governments on earth should arise to reduce it to utter submission. Nay, the human race as a whole should resolve, with every power at its disposal, to destroy that government. Should this greatest of all remedies be applied to the sick body of the world, it will assuredly recover from its ills and will remain eternally safe and secure. Observe that if such a happy situation be forthcoming, no government would need continually to pile up the weapons of war, nor feel itself obliged to produce ever new military weapons with which to conquer the human race. A small force for the purposes of internal security, the correction of criminal and disorderly elements, and the prevention of local disturbances would be required, no more. In this way, the entire population would, first of all, be relieved of the crushing burden of expenditure currently imposed for military purposes, and secondly, great numbers of people would cease to devote their time to the continual devising of new weapons of destruction, those testimonials of greed and bloodthirstiness so inconsistent with the gift of life, and would instead bend their efforts to the production of whatever will foster human existence and peace and well-being, and would become the cause of universal development and prosperity. Then every nation on earth will reign in honor, and every people will be cradled in tranquility and content. A few, unaware of the power latent in human endeavor, consider this matter as highly impracticable nay, even beyond the scope of man's utmost efforts. Such is not the case, however. On the contrary, thanks to the unfailing grace of God, the loving kindness of his favored ones, the unrivaled endeavors of wise and capable souls, and the thoughts and ideas of the peerless leaders of this age, nothing whatsoever can be regarded as unattainable. Endeavor, ceaseless endeavor, is required. Nothing short of an indomitable determination can possibly achieve it. Many a cause which past ages have regarded as purely visionary, yet in this day has become most easy and practicable. Why should this most great and lofty cause, the day star of the firmament of true civilization, and the cause of the glory, the advancement, the well-being, and the success of all humanity, be regarded as impossible of achievement? Surely the day will come when its beauteous light shall shed illumination upon the assemblage of man. The apparatus of conflict will, as preparations go on at their present rate, reach the point where war will become something intolerable to mankind. It is clear from what has already been said that man's glory and greatness do not consist in his being avid for blood and sharp of claw, in tearing down cities and spreading havoc, in butchering armed forces and civilians. What would mean a bright future for him would be his reputation for justice, his kindness to the entire population, whether high or low, his building up countries and cities, villages and districts, his making life easy, peaceful and happy for his fellow beings, his laying down fundamental principles for progress, his raising the standards and increasing the wealth of the entire population. Consider how throughout history many a king has sat on his throne as a conqueror. Among them were Halagu Khan and Tamerlane, who took over the vast continent of Asia, and Alexander of Macedon, and Napoleon I, who stretched their arrogant fists over three of the earth's five continents. And what was gained by all their mighty victories? Was any country made to flourish? Did any happiness result? Did any throne stand? Or was it rather that those reigning houses lost their power? Except that Asia went up in the flame of many battles and fell away to ashes, Genghis's Hulagu, the warlord, gathered no fruit from all his conquests. And Tamerlane, out of all his triumphs, reaped only the peoples blown to the winds and universal ruin. And Alexander had nothing to show for his vast victories, except that his son toppled from the throne and Philip and Ptolemy took over the dominions he once had ruled. And what did the first Napoleon gain from subjugating the kings of Europe, except the destruction of flourishing countries, the downfall of their inhabitants, the spreading of terror and anguish across Europe, and, at the end of his days, his own captivity? So much for the conquerors and the monuments they leave behind them. Contrast this with the praiseworthy qualities and the greatness and nobility of Anushirvan the generous and the just, the Sasanian king who reigned between 531 and 578 A.D. That fair-minded monarch came to power at a time when the once solidly established throne of Persia was about to crumble away. With his divine gift of intellect, he laid the foundations of justice, uprooting oppression and tyranny, and gathering the scattered peoples of Persia under the wings of his dominion. Thanks to the restoring influence of his continual care, Persia, that had lain withered and desolate, was quickened into life and rapidly changed into the fairest of all flourishing nations. He rebuilt and reinforced the disorganized powers of the state, and the renown of his righteousness and justice echoed across the seven climes. until the peoples rose up out of their degradation and misery to the heights of felicity and honor. Although he was a Magian, Muhammad, that center of creation, the son of prophethood, said of him, "I was born in the time of a just king and rejoiced at having come into the world during his reign." Did this illustrious personage achieve his exalted station by virtue of his admirable qualities, or rather by reaching out to conquer the earth and spill the blood of its peoples? Observe that he attained to such a distinguished rank in the heart of the world that his greatness still rings out through all the impermanence of time, and he won eternal life. Should we comment on the continuing life of the great, this brief essay would be unduly prolonged, and since it is by no means certain that public opinion in Persia will be materially affected by its perusal, we shall abridge the work and go on to other matters which come within the purview of the public mind. If, however, it develops that this abridgment produces favorable results, we shall, God willing, write a number of books dealing at length and usefully with fundamental principles of the divine wisdom in its relation to the phenomenal world. No power on earth can prevail against the armies of justice, and every citadel must fall before them, for men willingly go down under the triumphant strokes of this decisive blade, and desolate places bloom and flourish under the tramplings of this host. There are two mighty banners which, when they cast their shadow across the crown of any king, will cause the influence of his government quickly and easily to penetrate the whole earth, even as if it were the light of the sun. The first of these two banners is wisdom. The second is justice. Again, these two most potent forces, the Iron Hills, cannot prevail, and Alexander's wall will break before them. It is clear that life in this fast fading world is as fleeting and inconstant as the morning wind, and this being so, how fortunate are the great who leave a good name behind them and the memory of a lifetime spent in the pathway of the good pleasure of God. It is all one if it be a throne or the bare ground under the open sky where the pure soul lays him down to die. A conquest can be a praiseworthy thing, and there are times when war becomes the powerful basis of peace and ruin the very means of reconstruction. If, for example, a high-minded sovereign marshals his troops to block the onset of the insurgent and the aggressor, or again, if he takes the field and distinguishes himself in a struggle to unify a divided state and people, if, in brief, he is waging war for a righteous purpose, then this seeming wrath is mercy itself, and this apparent tyranny the very substance of justice, and this warfare the cornerstone of peace. Today, the task befitting great rulers is to establish universal peace, for in this lies the freedom of all peoples. The fourth phase of the aforementioned utterance, which points out the way of salvation, is obedient to the commandments of his Lord. It is certain that man's highest distinction is to be lowly before and obedient to his God, that his greatest glory, his most exalted rank and honor, depend on his close observance to the divine commands and prohibitions. Religion is the light of the world, and the progress, achievement, and happiness of man results from obedience to the laws set down in the holy books. Briefly, it is demonstrable that in this life, both outwardly and inwardly, the mightiest of structures, the most solidly established, the most enduring, standing guard over the world, assuring both the spiritual and the material perfections of mankind, and protecting the happiness and the civilization of society, is religion. It is true that there are foolish individuals who have never properly examined the fundamentals of the divine religions, who have taken as their criterion the behavior of a few religious hypocrites and measured all religious persons by that yardstick, and have on this account concluded that religions are an obstacle to progress, a divisive factor, and a cause of malevolence and enmity among people. They have not even observed this much, that the principles of the divine religions can hardly be evaluated by the acts of those who only claim to follow them. For every excellent thing, peerless though it may be, can still be diverted to the wrong end. A lighted lamp in the hands of an ignorant child or of the blind will not dispel the surrounding darkness nor light up the house. It will set both the bearer and the house on fire. Can we in such an instance blame the lamp? No, by the Lord God. To the seeing, a lamp is a guide and will show him his path, but it is a disaster to the blind. Among those who have repudiated religious faith was the Frenchman Voltaire, who wrote a great number of books attacking the religion, works which are no better than children's playthings. This individual, taking as his criterion the omissions and commissions of the Pope, the head of the Roman Catholic religion, and the intrigues and quarrels of the spiritual leaders of Christendom, opened his mouth and cavilled at the Spirit of God, Jesus. In the unsoundness of his reasoning, he failed to grasp the true significance of the sacred scriptures, took exception to certain portions of the revealed text, and dwelt on the difficulties involved. And we send down of the Koran that which is a healing and a mercy to the faithful, but it shall only add to the ruin of the wicked. The sage of Ghazna told the mystic story to his veiled hearers in an allegory. If those who err see naught in the Koran but only words, it's not to wonder on. Of all the sun's fire lighting up the sky, only the warmth can reach a blind man's eye. Many will he mislead by such parables, and many guide, but none will he mislead thereby except the wicked. It is certain that the greatest of instrumentalities for achieving the advancement and the glory of man, the supreme agency for the enlightenment and the redemption of the world, is love and fellowship and unity among all the members of the human race. Nothing can be effected in the world, not even conceivably, without unity and agreement. And the perfect means for engendering fellowship and union is true religion. Hadst thou spent all the riches of the earth, thou couldst not have united their hearts, but God hath united them. With the advent of the prophets of God, their power of creating a real union, one which is both external and of the heart, draws together malevolent peoples who have been thirsting for one another's blood into the one shelter of the Word of God. Then 100,000 souls become as one soul, and unnumbered individuals emerge as one body. Once they were as the waves of the sea, that the wind made many out of one. Then God shed down on them his Son, and his Son but one can never be. Souls of dogs and wolves go separately, but the soul of the lions of God is one. The events that transpired at the advent of the prophets of the past and their ways and works and circumstances are not adequately set down in authoritative histories, and are referred to only in condensed form in the verses of the Koran, the holy traditions, and the Torah. Since, however, all events from the days of Moses until the present time are contained in the mighty Koran, the authoritative traditions, the Torah, and other reliable sources, we shall content ourselves with brief references here, the purpose being to determine conclusively whether religion is the very basis and root principle of culture and civilization, or whether, as Voltaire and his like suppose, it defeats all social progress, well-being, and peace. to preclude once and for all objections on the part of any of the world's peoples, we shall conduct our discussion conformably to those authoritative accounts which all nations are agreed upon.
This is the end of side one, ending on page 75. Please turn the cassette.